The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Anyone who's had children knows that one of the most challenging stages of child rearing is that launch into adulthood. My guests today have been probing that difficult passage from adolescence into adulthood in animal species. And as difficult as that transition is for humans, those difficulties are amplified in mammals, birds, and reptilian species. Yet, these researchers have found similarities in the journey in four core life skills: staying safe, negotiating status with your peers and social groups, navigating sexuality, and learning self-reliance. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers have observed many species across several continents to make this argument on the commonality of essential experiences into maturity and relate these observations in their new book, Wildhood: The Epic Journey from Adolescence to Adulthood in Humans and Other Animals. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz is an evolutionary biologist and professor of medicine concurrently at Harvard and UCLA. Catherine Bowers is an animal behaviorist and science writer and a future tense fellow at the New America Foundation. They're co-authors of the previous bestseller, Zubiquity, and again, the name of their follow-up book is Wildhood. And they join us today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Your book, Wildhood, explores this passage from adolescence to adulthood in animal species, mammals, birds, and humans. And this exploration has led you to the conclusion that this passage has some great similarities across species on several foundational levels. What spurred this research?
The research that we did for this book included several components. One of them, well, first of all, Catherine and I have been working together for 10 years, turning to the animal world for insights and solutions to human problems. We spent the first 5 years focused on looking at heart disease and cancer and psychiatric disorders. I'm a physician and an evolutionary biologist, and Catherine's an animal behaviorist. But the last 5 years, we've been focusing on what we can learn about adolescent difficulties, human adolescent difficulties, by looking at adolescent animals. And so we've traveled around the world observing wild animal adolescents, literally in that phase of life. And in our offices at Harvard and UCLA, we have conducted these very broad and targeted reviews to identify commonalities and differences between adolescent animals. And we define that as fish and birds and reptiles, amphibians and mammals who have just gone through puberty but are not yet mature adults. So we've done a variety of things. And we also teach undergraduates a course on this topic. And they are between 18 and 22, so adolescents themselves.
And basically, between childhood and adulthood comes wildhood. It's that shared experience of adolescence in animals all over the world and through 600 million years of animal life on Earth.
And this is real scientific research as well as a book generated towards the general public, correct?
It is. What we've done is to identify patterns that had never been seen before because people have not been able to look as broadly as we have. A lot of it has to do with increasing power of internet search capacity. So we've been able to find these four universal challenges and skills of becoming a mature adult through this methodology. But what we've found, we really feel, can help parents and teachers and actually even psychotherapists who take care of adolescent patients, and then teenagers and young adults themselves. So yes, it's both scientific, but it's definitely, we had those readers in mind.
To do that, we told the story through four adolescent animals that are real-life animals tracked by scientists, and we interviewed the scientists who followed this penguin, hyena, humpback whale, and a wolf, and we tell their stories, and through their stories, tell the science.
Now, let me ask you, Catherine, this exploration begins on a California beach in an area known as the Triangle of Death for its abundance of great white sharks. What did you witness there, and how did that inform this story as it unfolds?
That is right. We were at the California coast by this area called the Triangle of Death. As you said, Barbara and I were there. We were studying the California sea otters there, and the biologist who was with us had us look out over the ocean, and he said it's called the Triangle of Death because it has more great white sharks than any other area of North America. And in fact, 40% of all shark encounters happen there in that part of the ocean. The biologists themselves won't even get out of their boats. There's so many sharks. And all the wild animals that live in the water have learned to stay away, except for one particular kind of animal, and those are the adolescent sea otters. And Barbara and I looked at each other and just thought, wow, that's an example of adolescent risk-taking in a population of wild animals. And what does that have to do with our own human teens? So we were researching our book, Ubiquity, at the time, and it was looking across nature and wild animals to see how we could better understand human health. But we also were both raising adolescent animals of our own at the time. We had teenagers in our homes, and that kind of risk-taking that you see in adolescents but not in younger animals or older animals reminded us of teenagers that we knew, and we knew that we had something important to research here.
Now, your book identifies four core life skills that humans and animals share. What are they?
They are, first, staying safe. So in order for a young adolescent to acquire the next three skills, he or she has to keep himself safe from predators and exploiters. And that, you know, is a important but difficult job. In the beginning, young adolescents are what are called predator naive because they lack experience, and consequently they can be easy prey. So number one is staying safe. Number two, adolescents need to learn about status. And by that we mean what their relationship is with all the other animals in their group and how to navigate hierarchies. And that actually directly connects to social media addiction and obsession. The third skill is they need to learn to communicate sexually. They need to learn how to do courtship and that sort of very important conversation with others. And then finally, self-reliance. They need to learn how to feed themselves, find food, and find shelter. So independence and self-reliance.
Now, in each of these foundational life skills, as you mentioned earlier, Catherine, you share a number of examples, but one species is pointed out as the guide for the skill. In the case of staying safe, it's Ursula, that king penguin you mentioned earlier. What's special about this species when it comes to staying safe?
Yeah, Ursula is a king penguin who one day, with her other fledgling penguins, leaps into the ocean and swims away from her home. And what Ursula represents is something that we all are when we first are big in body but low in experience in the world, and that is the inexperience and vulnerability of adolescence. So it's not specific to her species necessarily, but every adolescent that moves into the world has this vulnerability because they are treated as an adult. They are out there on their own without parental care, and yet they don't yet have the experience to take care of themselves.
Dangerous place to be, by the way, because when adolescents, you know, when our kids are, let's say, middle school or early high school, they may be physically big. They may actually look from a distance like adults. My own 13-year-old was 6 feet tall. But because, as Catherine said, they lack experience, there are actual predators in nature who target those adolescent animals because they know that they're out on their own for the first time without having parents look right over them. So they won't recognize the moves. And we think that human exploiters do a very similar thing.
One of the primary ways that adolescent animals learn what those dangers are is counterintuitive. They actually have to take the risk. They have to go out in the world a bit and have brushes with the real world. You know, it's not necessarily what you would want your adolescent child to have, but there is a sense of understanding what's out in the world can help them survive later.
In fact, you've noticed this behavior where oftentimes the animals will actually approach the danger to get a sense of it, to understand it. They're so predator naive, they actually go up to the predator sometimes.
That's right, and they do it with peers. There's safety in numbers. And in fact, there's some experiments that show that young fish who are deprived of the opportunity to do this and to do it with peers really are never as safe as those who have had a chance to do this, even though there is some risk associated with the predator inspection itself.
Now, in the case of Ursula, it's really, I found this very interesting that you would expect that a parent in some species, there's sort of this teaching moment of, you know, increasing self-reliance. But in the case of king penguins, it's like the penguin is on land, totally fed by parents, until one day it just leaves. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not that uncommon among mammals and birds that you see this sort of, that there's a dispersal, a day where they leave. Sometimes it's called the day of independence. However, it turns out there is something called practice dispersals that, you know, different mammals and birds where young, soon to leave adolescents actually spend the night away and come back, or in some cases actually will go on these excursions with their parents. This is in some species of birds. The parents take their soon to leave the nest adolescents out on excursions to see where they're going to go and where the best flocks are. So there is some preparation. And then, interestingly, and this was very surprising to me because I sort of thought, well, in nature, you know, yeah, birds leave and that's it. They've literally left the nest. But it turns out sometimes if conditions are really difficult, there isn't enough food, and parents have the resources, some penguins actually come back after their first season or two to be fed. So there's what's called extended parental care in nature.
Well, we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves as far as how the story works, but let's talk about this leaving, you know, the self-reliance, the last skill. You know, in the animal world compared to humans, self-reliance generally is a fairly harsh measure. But again, there are several times in the book where you say, you know, we have this incomplete knowledge of how animal behavior works. We've watched so many nature documentaries that have given us a fairly rigid expectation of how this process unfolds. But as with humans, it seems that this date of parental separation has some flexibility. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, and I really like how you said that. That flexibility was really surprising and actually kind of a relief for us. I mean, my kids are now in their early 20s, but they were adolescents when we were researching and writing this. And, you know, I was, like all parents, I had my worries. And, you know, you hear, there's too much helicopter parenting, or there's all these rules and these ideas about what should be. And what's really interesting is that if you look across nature at what literally is natural, what we see is flexibility because, ultimately environments are different and the temperament and the abilities of young vary. So that's exactly right.
And the idea that the purpose of adolescence itself is to have the opportunity to do all this practicing and, whether it's learning how to express desire for another animal or learn courtship and, try a little bit and fail and figure out what that means, or whether you're practicing hunting your own food, getting, foraging a healthy meal, all of that. Many, many animals, even animals that I really never thought of as needing practice, do need to be taught. They need to make mistakes. They need to figure it out. And adolescence is the time they do this.
That term, doing it naturally, which, sometimes is applied, to, let's say, sexuality. What was really interesting, as Catherine said, is that, even something like the sexual life of a wild animal, that for many species, they go through puberty, but they don't immediately start mating and having offspring. There is a period of, I'm going to say waiting in air quotes, because it's not conscious, of course, but where they have to learn the courtship dance or the songs, and they really need to be older. So sometimes there can be up to 4 years in some bird species, for example, between puberty when their bodies can make offspring and when they actually start to mate.
And until they learn how to act appropriately with one another in that context, they often are sort of kept from mating, again, not consciously, but just by their own behavioral immaturity. And we actually think there's a lot for humans to learn from that.
My guests today are Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz. She is a Harvard and UCLA evolutionary biologist, and Catherine Bowers, an animal behaviorist and science writer. They are co-authors of Wildhood, The Epic Journey from Adolescence to Adulthood in Humans and Other Animals. They're our guests today on Studio Tulsa. That third section on navigating sexuality, I found this so interesting that species don't move directly from sexual maturity to reproduction. And I think this just goes against everything we've ever heard in nature documentaries. And they've given this real incomplete picture of how young adult animals decide to reproduce or not. What is the reason for the delay? I can understand males not being dominant enough to do that. And again, this is sort of one of those memes that goes along with this, but I would assume that once females become sexually mature, they would reproduce. Why the delay? Do we know?
Well, as you just mentioned, there are many different examples. So there's lots of reasons, and it depends on the species and the environment and the ecology and all those sorts of things. But the takeaway for us was really that it is pretty widespread as a phenomenon. Of course, it's not always the case. There are times when, yeah, reproductive maturity leads immediately to breeding. But just how often that isn't the case, we thought was fascinating. And one way of understanding it broadly is that immature, well, at least for mammals and birds where there's direct parental care, and even in about 20 to 30% of fish, there's direct parental care. You know, we sometimes think fish just lay the eggs and leave, and many of them do, but there is parental care in about 20 to 30% of species. By the way, fathers provide a lot of that care. But what's interesting is that until an animal is mature enough, that first set of offspring don't do very well. And they may not know how to nurse well or protect the offspring. And interesting with the fish, it's just I just love this example. You know, there are these fathers who provide parental care, these fish fathers. And sometimes they they're called mouth brooders because the eggs incubate in their mouths. And then when the fish hatch, the little fry live in their mouths. They go out and swim, and then they come back for protection. But first-time fathers, sometimes they're just inexperienced. They sometimes swallow their first couple of broods. So inexperienced parents don't tend to have very good outcomes. So that may be part of what underlies this delay, let's say, between reproductive maturity, that is bodies that can make babies and offspring, and actually mating.
And as we were researching this over the 5 years of our study, we came to see courtship as Barbara said, as a signal of maturity. So it lets the ability to do a proper courtship ritual is a signal to the rest of the group that, you're mature enough to maybe take on some of those other responsibilities. But we also realized that it's a very complex and nuanced conversation between the two animals about whether they're going to continue at each step. So you have to be able to, you have to signal your desire, you have to understand the desire of the other animal, and then at every step it's this test of will we or won't we, should we or shouldn't we, that again is two-way. And we think that that's really a very interesting topic nowadays with especially campus and other conversations about consent and coercion. And we think that the idea that there's these deep, ancient, ingrained patterns of behavior that have to be learned and practiced and discussed can maybe inform the discussion about consent and coercion in people.
If your listeners are interested in seeing some pretty, I think, amazing videos of adolescent birds practicing, not so effectively, these moves, we have them on wildhood.com, which is our website. So you see sort of the mature bald eagles doing this magnificent courtship spiral where they put their talons out and they grab midair and then they spiral down like two ice skaters in the Olympics. And those are mature adults, but then the adolescents just practice and practice. And so we have videos of sort of the fails of, practicing this tough move and not quite making it. So,
well, I found that interesting that courtship has to be learned. It's not innate in most of these animal species.
Yep, we found that fascinating as well. Yeah. A fruit fly has a complex courtship ritual that involves singing and chasing and dancing and bowing and a leg tap and all these many, many steps it needs to figure out how to do. A humpback whale or a blue whale also has a complex courtship that also involves singing and certain behaviors that have to be offered up and then responded to. And it's sort of like, a big world of courtship and romance happening right before our very eyes that we don't really ever look at.
And, it's interesting because we teach 18 to 22-year-olds, and we ask them, they're just out of high school, and we say, what do you wish you'd learned in your human health courses where, sometimes they're called sex ed or whatever. And most of them say, look, they get a lot of education about, pregnancy prevention and protecting themselves from diseases, et cetera. But almost all of them say they really want to, believe it or not, they use the word romance, that they feel like that's a sort of an ignored part of their generation, and they crave it. And we thought that there's really interesting examples we give them in the book of how that works, what sort of wild animal sex ed is, which is really about just a conversation.
Well, one of the things I found really interesting is that just as coercion plays a role in human sex roles, coercion plays a role in the animal sex world as well.
Yes, this is something that, has been studied now for quite a while. And, of course, it's important to make the obvious point that just because something happens in nature certainly does not mean that we endorse it in human life. My goodness, animals can commit infanticide and cannibalism and all kinds of things that most humans in my life would just, you know, say, oh my God, those are horrible. In other words, we say up front that, of course, you know, pointing out that coercion exists in animals is important to understand coercion in humans. But, of course, just like all these other things, something we see in nature and that our species has a capacity to rise above. But there are a lot of lessons, we think, to be learned about how coercion works in nature. And one of the things that was fascinating was to learn that there are some chimpanzees where the female, when she's fertile, approaches the male as if she's interested in him. And for a long time, scientists thought, well, that's an example of female choice. But it turned out they pulled the lens back and they looked at the power dynamic in the troop, and they realized that, in fact, the females were being intimidated by those males. So we think that's sort of interesting, that just because it doesn't look coercive doesn't mean it's not. And in this era of Me Too and all of these important conversations, we think that's a really interesting additional perspective.
Another fascinating thing we learned was that adolescents that don't get courtship training, whether they're they've looked at, you know, hamsters or guinea pigs who are kept separate from their peers when they're in adolescence, they have trouble later with coercion and consent. They often don't know how to approach a possible mate. They don't know how to act appropriately when they're with that mate. So it's really important in terms of coercion to, you know, have in real life experiences with the give and take of courtship.
Well, I found the second skill, your negotiating status, and this gets into all sorts of contemporary issues regarding humans and how we use social media and bullying and all these important issues. But you're looking at it in the animal world for the most part, and you use a hyena, and a hyena from the lowest rank of his clan. What was special about this species and this particular subject as it can tell us how we behave as humans?
Well, status plays a role in every social in the life of every social animal, from fish to, you know, to mammals. But hyena society is particularly status conscious, and it turns out hyenas are one of the spotted hyenas are one of the species, mammalian species, where females are in charge. I mean, big time. The dominants are the females, but yet there's a hierarchy, and there's a high-ranking female, and then the number two, and so on, and then there's the low-ranking female. And the animal that we feature was the son of the lowest-ranking hyena mother in this group. And so his fortunes, based on his birth, were not very good at all. But interestingly, he did two things that really changed the course of his life, and he ended up, it's actually a hyena rags-to-riches story, quite a remarkable true story. But the two things that Schrenk did, that was the name that the German biologists who were studying him gave him, he understood the power of coalition and allies. Essentially, he knew how to make friends, and he used that social ability to rise in the ranks, to secure more resources, and that sort of thing. But the other thing that Schrenk had, which was he was fortunate about, he was, in a sense, unfortunate that he was born to such a low place in hyena society. But there are two large populations of hyenas in Africa. One is in the Ngorongoro Crater in Tanzania, which is where Schrenk was from, and the other is in the Serengeti. Well, the Ngorongoro Crater is much lusher and richer. There are far more prey species per kilometer than there are in the Serengeti. It's much harsher. And so Schrenk had the advantage of being born into an environment where there were more resources and where there was just more opportunity. Had he been born in the Serengeti, it's unclear whether he would have risen as he did, and we tell his story in the book.
And I found it interesting that hyenas have this strong parental intervention. In fact, it's maternal intervention from the high-ranking members of their clan, sort of ensuring that their offspring sort of inherit their status, because it sort of relates to, you know, how high the upper classes sort of ensure that their children also continue to be upper class.
Yes, it's called maternal intervention, but fathers can do it as well. And it's essentially exactly as you described, where high-ranking parents observing the contest of their offspring basically intervene to make sure that their offspring come out on top. And there are quite a few other things that happen in hyena and other animal societies where, you know, we call it privileged creatures, that you know, some animals inherit territory and social networks from their parents. And and others might not be as fortunate. And you know, those things are going to influence the destinies of those adolescent animals.
The idea of animal nepotism was just really fascinating to us, because what we mean by animals inheriting territory is literally that. If a red squirrel, high-ranking red squirrel mother gives her territory to her offspring, they get all of the territory plus all of the acorns hidden on it. Or we read about beaver inheritance, where they get all of the structures that are already on that land. And we found that animals can inherit the social networks of their parents as well. And those are in animals as different as whales and cockroaches. I mean, just a wide range of animals where they actually get their parents' social network, which, as you know, we know from humans, can really give them a boost as they're moving out into the world.
But we also point out that, you know, we are unique. I mean, every species is unique. We're not uniquely unique, but we are unique. And one of the ways that we are unique is that we have insight, and we can rise above, if we choose to, we can rise above some of these instincts. So I remember when my brother was playing Little League, and his pal's father was the Little League coach. But his pal's father went out of his way to make sure that his son was not, you know, playing more or getting favoritism. But these are things that human beings can do because we are. We can be aware of it, and we can rise above our animal natures, in a sense.
We really do believe that that's something we can do as humans, and that we have a collective responsibility as adults to care about adolescents other than our own. So that is something that we can do with this knowledge and these conversations.
I should mention that in the book, you are careful to say, you know, there are certain things that apply to humans, other things that apply to animals. But of course, as you well know, and you write in the book, there's been this rethinking and debate between those who see connections between animal and human behavior, biology, and emotional states, and those who believe that those connections are overstated. How does that debate influence your work and how you view these connections between adolescent species?
We're scientists. We approach things very skeptically, and we aren't going to make any kind of claims unless we're quite sure that they are accurate. And so we would understate things, but even in the most understated, skeptical way, it is becoming impossible to ignore the mounting evidence that non-human animals, and I'm talking about mammals and birds and possibly even fish, but let's just stick with mammals for a moment, have many of the same responses that we do to experiences, including loss and grief, excitement and joy, pain and pleasure. Even the changes in the brains of other animals when they rise in status are similar to the changes in our brains when we gain popularity. And the converse is when an animal experiences what's called status descent, where they rapidly fall in rank, the changes in their brains are very similar to the changes in our brains when we experience humiliation, so which is status descent. So there is such mounting evidence from the world of neuroimaging, comparative neuroimaging, that is when we're looking at these structures and the functions of the brains of non-human animals, and actually also studying their responses to challenges from the marshmallow test. I mean, we know that birds perform very similarly to young kids on the marshmallow test, to problem solving, all kinds of seemingly human phenomenon. We are finding very compelling evidence for not, you know, identical responses, but for very, very similar higher level function than we ever thought before.
The name of the book is Wildhood. Barbara and Catherine, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Evolutionary biologist Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and animal behaviorist and science writer Catherine Bowers are the co-authors of Wildhood, the epic journey from adolescence to adulthood in humans and other animals. It's published by Scribner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.